Welcome to the Product Makers Podcast, where we interview and have open conversations with product makers and leaders from both large enterprises and startups about their experiences in growing successful products, teams, and companies around the world. I'm your host, Adam Davis, here at Product Board. Now, today, my guest is John Silch, who is a Senior Director of Product at Sugar CRM. Today in this episode, we talk about product quality. Now, not in the sense of software testing, but how you can ship quality products to customers. We discuss the importance of business and product strategy. We use the Titanic as an analogy of what can go wrong if you aren't balancing the different levers to ship quality products for your customers. And we also discuss the importance of creating the right culture in your teams. Now, thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. John, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast. So you are the Senior Director of Product at Sugar CRM. And for listeners that don't know, can you tell us a little bit about what Sugar CRM does?
Yeah, sure. So we are a full marketing sales automation platform and support. Been around now for quite a while. And, Salesforce automation, marketing automation, helping sales and marketers hit their revenue goals.
Awesome. And how's business been this year? How are things?
It's great. Yeah, it's been a good year for us and just about ready to head down to a customer event tomorrow. So can't wait to meet all of our customers and hang out. So I'm excited for that.
Brilliant. And where is the event? What's happening?
Austin, Texas. And basically a fully remote company. So just to get out of the house and go meet people in 3D will be really exciting.
Brilliant. How many people are in Sugar CRM?
At our company, we're about 450, I want to say, somewhere around there.
Wow. Awesome. And fully remote?
And just about, yeah. A couple offices still open, but fully remote.
Brilliant. All right, John. Well, before we get into it and we have a good kind of product conversation, to get started, I wanted to do a little bit of a quick fire. That's what we'd like to do with some of our guests, just so they get to know you a little bit before we get into some of the meaty bits. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions. We'll run through that. Does that sound all right?
I'm a little nervous, but I'm excited. I don't know what's coming.
All right. Well, they're fine. They're easy.
Okay. All right.
So the first one is, they're asking everyone this, what's your favorite beverage? Now, this can be alcoholic or non-alcoholic, but what's your favorite beverage and why?
Yeah, I've got three of them in front of me right now. One of them is a Starbucks coffee, which is my go-to. I would say on the adult beverage side, I think it's Oktoberfest now, right over in Germany.
Yeah,
I'm partially German, so celebrate my heritage a little bit here. And I've got I don't even know how to pronounce it, Spaten Premium Lager.
Oh, sweet.
I'm saying it like a Bostonian, right? Because I'm in Boston, I'm saying Spaten, like Spartan, but with the Boston accent. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, but it's a wonderful beer, very light and very tasty. So,
nice. So what was your third? You mentioned the coffee.
Just water.
Water, all right.
Nothing too exciting there.
Awesome. And for listeners, we do ask before I drink your beverage. So he doesn't have a beer at 8 a.m.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Next one. Your favorite travel destination and why?
Ooh, that's a good one. I've only been there a couple times, but I would say if I had to, I'd like to go back soon. Probably St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Pristine beaches, kind of low key. Some good hiking there too, which my wife and I like. So yeah, I would go with St. John.
That's Caribbean, right? Or Caribbean?
Yes. Yep.
All right. What's your favorite product at the moment? So it can be anything.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Spotify. I'm a huge music lover, probably using Spotify, when I'm walking the dog. And I just love the UX, really easy to use. And they helped me do one of my favorite things, which is discover new music. So every Monday, for those, who are familiar with Spotify, they'll publish the Discover Weekly playlist. And I absolutely love it. It's great just to hear music that I've never heard before. Their AI algorithms actually, I would say deliver, right, on what a lot of companies say their AI algorithms are going to do. Spotify really does a great job with that.
Yeah, I love it. What's one overhyped product topic that's going around? Like, what do you think is a little bit overhyped and it's doing the rounds at the moment?
So the one I always rail about, and it's mostly out of jealousy because I wish I could operate the way that a lot of folks are, which is around continuous discovery and, some of the more thoughtful product evangelists out there have written books about it. And it sounds it sounds awesome, right? To continuously deploy code and sit there and watch how customers are using it and then tweak it. And, you know, I've been in the enterprise space for a while, for most of my career, at least part of most of my product career. And I just haven't, you know, for me, it's not that easy. And for us, it's not that easy. And it's takes a little more thought to go to market or to launch anything and to, you know, enable the people on our side, enable our customers, even if it's for a smaller group of customers. Yeah, I just haven't, you know, been able to do that. But I've always been on the B2B side, you know, selling to businesses who typically sell to businesses. So maybe on the consumer side, you can do a little bit more of that. But yeah, that one I feel like a little more hype than what I'm seeing in the real world.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think I've spent a lot of my career in B2B SaaS as well. And there's certainly a lot of good tools and techniques, but it's certainly a little bit more challenging. I think a little bit more work could be done on different discovery tactics for B2B SaaS. But that's kind of another topic, but like it. All right, I've got two more for you. What's one thing you've changed recently in how you approach your work that's made a difference?
Well, probably, and it's taken some convincing, but not all projects need to be agile. I think with SaaS and agile and or Scrum, I should say, with product management, it seems like it's the most popular mechanism for, you know, for managing initiatives. And I think it's there's perfectly reasonable situations where waterfall, you know, is the right fit, right? You know exactly what you need to build. There isn't much, you know, variation or discovery, I guess, to use that word again, that you're going to have to do with customers. So to, you know, you kind of know what it's going to look like at the end. Not, again, not all projects, but I think in some cases we've had initiatives where it's perfectly fine to say, we're going to actually manage this in a waterfall approach. And where I've done that, we've been quite successful. Now, it's not the norm. It's typically the outlier, but they do come along where it just makes more sense and it's faster to use a more waterfall approach.
Yeah. And without putting you too much on the spot, is there, I guess, an example you could give listeners in terms of a type of initiative or project that you feel may just be better suited to waterfall and not kind of going through that whole rigmarole of using Agile?
Definitely. So we're going to talk about product quality in a minute, and we were trying to basically improve the performance of our product. And in order to do so, we needed to upgrade some of the technology behind it. And that required real engineering hours. It was a large project. And we started off doing what we always did, you know, grooming stories and going into a sprint. And but I found we were spending a lot of time together doing that kind of work on items that just didn't require a whole lot of conversation, or at least not in terms of what customers were looking for, right? And we sort of knew what they were asking for. They were asking for better performance. And finally, I asked the team, hey, we're doing a lot of these retros and planning and grooming. Would it be easier just to write a PRD for what we're looking to do? Put those, you know, those tasks in and just go after it, right? Not even look at this in a sprint format. And once we did that, we kind of were able to put our heads down. We'd have our, you know, basically project management check-ins, changed our whole approach. And I think we reached the finish line in a much better way, a much faster way. And looking back, it seemed obvious to do it that way. But at the time, you know, it was a lever that we pulled that I'm happy we did.
Right. So if I'm kind of hearing you correctly, if you're feeling pretty certain, you got high confidence in terms of what you want to solve, just go after it and be a little bit more pragmatic.
Yeah, Adam, exactly. I think if you have confidence around what that end result is going to look like and feel like, then it, you know, probably doesn't require doing something like Scrum where you're, you know, putting things in front of customers and getting feedback as you go.
Awesome. All right. And final one, what's your advice to having a successful career? Nice little zinger for the end of this quickfire.
In product management, I would say one thing that I wish I had done more of is, I have been at companies where product management has been sort of the nucleus of the company and we've done product really well. I think at Sugar CRM, we do product pretty well. At Intuit, where I started, definitely a product company, a fantastic product company. And I would say, especially if you're starting out, find a company like that where the products are highly regarded. You have a pretty good, a pretty high confidence that they do product management at a high level, and just glom onto there so you learn, right? Even if you're in a role that maybe you wouldn't have taken otherwise. But I think that will help instill some of the best practices for you as a product manager, help you network, obviously, with people that are really good at what they do. And it'll set you off in the right direction. Because I think being inversely, you know, inverse to that is being at a company that really doesn't do product management as well. And then you're going to find yourself building muscles early on that are not the ones you should be building, and creating habits that are going to be hard to break out of. I think that's really important, right? You find better mentors that way. You'll, again, you'll just learn the art and science of product management from those who do it best.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think I was really fortunate earlier in my career to actually start in sales, and then I transitioned to product. But I worked for a company called TradeMe, which is like the Amazon of New Zealand for folks that haven't heard about it. And they just had a fantastic product culture. And I think the principles, the leadership that you see, and the quality in terms of their approach of how they deliver things to market, what they create, is just so fundamental to someone earlier in their career. So yeah, I completely, completely agree.
Cool.
All right. So today, we're going to talk about building quality products, right?
Would love to. My favorite topic.
Well, yeah, let's kind of jump into it. How do you think about quality products?
Yeah, this ties into your last question, I guess. It's not something that I thought about a lot when I first started. When I first started, it was, what's the next feature we're going to build? And what's the next feature we're going to build after that? And, you know, looking back on it, so I've been in product management for 10 years. Prior to that, I was in project management for about 10 years. So an interesting kind of yin and yang there in my career. I think maybe when you hear quality, right, if you're listening to this episode, you're thinking, oh, we're going to talk about testing automation, right? Or, you know, best practices toward testing, or what does quality mean, and user requirements. And I think that's just one corner of this whole topic of product quality, which I honestly am quite obsessed with, because I feel like today with product managers, there's a lot of pressure, at least what I've seen, and I've worked at several companies. There's pressure to deliver things, right? There's analysts saying you need to go and deliver these features next. There's deadlines, right? A lot of companies will publish a roadmap. And even if it says now, next, later, right? There's this understanding that, okay, this feature is coming soon. And I need to go and put that out to the world. And I had fallen into that trap as well, especially early on. It's like, well, here's my roadmap. Here's the plan. So, and then of course there's resource constraints too, which makes it really hard for us to do all of these things when we might not be given the resources that we truly need as product managers. So not everyone is dealing with all of those constraints, but I think a lot of us are dealing with at least a couple of them. And for me, and I hope it's just me, but I doubt that it is. I bet this affects everyone. You're trying to juggle these things and pull all three levers. How can I deliver something by a certain date that includes all this stuff, but only do it with the people that I have at my, you know, at our disposal here on the team? And when you do that math out, that algebra, it works, right? You can actually make it work. But I think what people forget about is that quality is what suffers typically, right? So to get that stuff out by a certain date with the resources that you have, and maybe not being given extra resources, it's product quality that takes a huge hit. And that's sort of what I had been studying over the past couple of years, thinking about the Iron Triangle, which Martin Barnes created, you know, 50 years ago, right? As part of his thesis, he was a PhD student in England, and was looking at contract management and writing about that, and said, you know, you've got these three levers: time, scope, and resources. And as you pull those levers, they're going to change the other ones, and quality is kind of your output, right? So when I think of quality, it's really the goodness, the excellence of the product, and is it going to satisfy the needs of an intended audience? It's not bugs necessarily. It's not just bugs. It's not just performance, right? It's everything. And it's, does this product, this feature, this thing that I've put out to the world satisfy the audience the way it's supposed to?
Mm-hmm. And you touched on it a little bit, but I think it would be interesting for the listeners to unpack a little bit. Like, why do you think product managers or product teams get into this position where they aren't able to ship quality products? Like, I've been on teams before where you know that you should be, I don't know, delivering a little bit more against the acceptance criteria for a user story, or one additional feature to try and get the MVP out. Like, why do you think teams are falling into this trap?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first, I think the best ones don't. But I know I started off by saying I think a lot of people do, and I've inherited products where that's definitely been the case. You know, I do think it's a cultural problem, right? And a cultural opportunity to improve the culture to get around this problem, which is just not understanding the impact that quality output's going to have. Right. So we sort of think of it this way. We think of it as we have a roadmap and our sales team might be out there selling that roadmap. And on that roadmap might be widget A. And we have it in the now column, right? And there's also, we've got six people on our Scrum team. If we deliver widget A by this date, right? Because maybe a couple salespeople have dangled that in front of customers. With the six people that we have, we will have been successful. So I think success is defined as, and we hear about this all the time, I'm not the first person to make this case, output over outcomes, right? I think companies look at output over outcomes as success when it should be the reverse. It should be outcomes over output. And I think sometimes we don't understand what that outcome should be for a customer. Right? We just don't think of it that way. We think of it from an internal position of, I need to get this widget A out by a certain date with the resources that I have. And if I do, I will be able to put that on my resume. I will be able to put that on my performance review at my company, and I will be able to say, yes, I did this thing. Does that, I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but I think that's part of the trap, is that leadership is actually scoring product teams or even Scrum teams, right? With that metric of, did you get this thing out by the time you said you were going to get it out by?
Yeah, no, certainly. And like I've experienced that a lot as well. And a lot of folks that I speak with, and I think it's really hard for us to shift from feeling that success or that pressure of just getting something out the door and forgetting about it. And I don't know, like, do you think that's a symptom of maybe an older style of leadership or how we think about product or different companies? So I know every company certainly doesn't operate that way, but like, what do you think, there's kind of a deeper condition or symptom in terms of why we think that way?
So I do have this theory that I've been kind of batting around in my head, that if you look at other job functions, right? So accounting, what I could tell, accounting goes back 3000 BC as a job function. So, you know, what's that? 5000. I mean, it goes back forever, right? Or 300, I don't know. I'm not good at history, but whatever it is, 300 BC, 3000 would be a long time. It's early here and I haven't had my full coffee. So 300 BC is when accounting came about, right? In product management, and especially, you know, just as it applies to software, I think product managers probably existed for retail and fashion and things like that before, but with software, it was somewhere probably around the middle of the 2000s, would you say? I don't know, Adam, when you think product management really came into fashion.
Well, I keep hearing it's new. So I still speak to a lot of people who regard it as new, and that's completely fine, you know, right? Based on kind of their experience or where they've come from. But I feel like maybe, 2010, 2011, 2012, it started really maybe taken off a little bit more. Yeah, probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago or so.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's super recent. And with that, right, I think we have, and this is not a shot against any, you know, chief product officers that are out there. And I'm probably like this too, right? I'm in a senior director position where I'm sure there's a generation behind me saying, hey, this guy does not know product management. Well, and I'm guessing, I'd love to know what those gaps are, but I'm sure I have my gaps. As I mentioned, I started in project management. So when you take people from other functions, you bring them into product management. And I've seen this a lot with, you know, folks who've come from marketing or operations or engineering. They're ported over to product management to say, hey, we need someone to run this department, this team, and they're going to bring with them their expertise from another role. Whereas I think now we're seeing this growing up, this maturity of product managers from a younger generation that will over time, you know, become your senior leaders at these organizations and have said, yes, I've spent my career doing product management. And frankly, I'm optimistic about that. I think we'll be in a much better place. And I know I just said we'll be in a better place when I'm replaced, but in a way that's true. I think we're going to have folks that learn this at a really young age. You know, we don't see college courses in product management yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's coming as well, because I do think it's a function that is really important. And it will help with what we were talking about before, where I think leadership will say, okay, let's not talk about dates and things that we're doing. Let's ask ourselves a really important question. Does the product that we have today or the product that we're building do what we said it's going to do, or do what our customers expect? And I'll ask you this, Adam, because I think it's interesting, right? This podcast episode that people are listening to right now, it's a product, right? And I'm curious what you would think. What are some of the adjectives that people expect from this episode or from this podcast in general?
Yeah, well, hopefully we've got a few listeners, but I think for me, it's really what I look for in a podcast in terms of you can learn new knowledge, you find it interesting in hearing other people's stories, you can empathize with it, should be able to give you some energy to kind of help you with your day job. They're all the types of things that I look for in podcasts, and that kind of inspiration that I'm not the only one there, other people are facing these challenges, I want to learn something new, and it's something that I can check in on. So I completely agree. And I think kind of building on that and maybe flipping it to yourself, like how do you think about shipping quality products at Sugar CRM?
Yeah, so exactly. So if I had to equate it to what you just said about this podcast episode, I think that everything in this world, you know, has adjectives that customers expect. The beer that I'm still not drinking, by the way, it's 8 a.m. I've got a guitar sitting next to me. You know, everything we look at has these quality dimensions to it. And I'm going to answer your question in a second. And I think you nailed it, right? For this podcast, they want engaging, they want inspirational, they want informative, right? And there's a level of familiarity that would be nice, right? So maybe it needs to be somewhat therapeutic too. So all of those things, right, is going to leave people saying, this was a good episode, this was helpful to me, or this is what I expected to get out of it. Same thing with sugar. So I look at really all SaaS products, especially, you know, the product that I manage at Sugar CRM, which is Sugar Market, our marketing automation module. I look at it across six different dimensions. I say, is it secure? And that's usually the first one, because that one's the one we can probably toggle the least. Is it performant? Is it stable, right? Performant meaning, is it going to go fast enough? Is it going to work the way? Stable just means, is it up, obviously? Is it reliable for us to use? Is it efficient, meaning is it going to save us time? Is it accurate? You know, so are the metrics that we're giving back, whatever it might be, are those actually reflecting reality, which is important for quality? And then in this one, again, is something we invested in over the last year. Is it intuitive enough, right? Can someone just use it without going through our support docs, or without calling our support team, or without being trained on it? Not always, but I think that's really important, especially in today's day and age, right? The bar is so high for products to perform, to be intuitive, to save us time, to not have a lot of noise in it. That bar is a lot higher now than it was when product management started 10, 15 years ago. So to answer your question, we literally think about those six, what I call pillars of product quality, right? Those six adjectives with each release, right? And we look at the metrics behind them and say, how are we doing there? And then also, what do our customers expect? They obviously expect it to be secure, right? We need to protect all the data privacy and be compliant and all that stuff. So that one's kind of locked in. But performance, right? So we're marketing automation. How fast do emails need to go out? And that's really important to us, right? It's important for us to talk to our customers and say, what's your expectation, right? And what other products have you used? What is the competition doing? As I mentioned, intuitiveness, right? Really, really critical for us as well. It was somewhere we found we could get better, and we did. We invested a lot to remove a lot of the noise in our product and to make it more straightforward and focus on the core value proposition that our product claims to have. So we measure these things. We ask our customers. So there's a quantitative and a qualitative piece to it. And what we found, and this is where I think, you know, rubber hits the road, is we have found that when we invest in those areas on new features, but also more importantly on existing features, we see better metrics, both from a product side and from the commercial side. We see that our customers are rating the product higher. They're using the product. It's more sticky. And we see our churn numbers go down. And we have enough data at this point to say, yes, this investment was worth it. So that's really refreshing and validating that a focus on product quality is going to pay off in dividends, right? A lot of times we go into the next quarter or something saying, wouldn't it be great if we delivered these three or four new features? And I think what we fail to do is ask our customers, is that what you would do, right? Or would you rather us focus on the stuff we already have and make it better? And sometimes it's the former and sometimes it's the latter, but I think it's really, really important to have your finger on the pulse of how customers are feeling about your core product and making sure that that's being protected.
And with those, I really like that kind of approach in terms of the pillars of quality. In companies I've worked in, like Hootsuite and also Product Board at the moment, we kind of think about these pillars or themes. So one thing I'm curious about is, so you have these kind of six pillars, and do they come down from like the business strategy or the product strategy? Like, how are they created?
Yes, that's a great point, and something I care deeply about. It is closely to those pillars, and how well you need to do across those pillars are super, they're very, very tied to the corporate strategy. The corporate strategy will funnel into those pillars, which I think of as the product strategy, frankly, and maybe not the full product strategy, but a big part of the product strategy. Corporate strategy is really important. So I like to use this example, the Titanic, right? Which is obviously a catastrophe or disaster, but I think enough time's passed where I can use it. So with the Titanic, you think about those six pillars, right? And how does that tie to the strategy? Well, this was a high-end, you know, for the most part, it was a high-end tourism and entertainment venture, right? From White Star Line, and they were going to go across the Atlantic, and they sold to some really high-end clients, and their strategy was to do that. And a lot of folks say, well, you know, they hit the iceberg, obviously the ship went down. Well, it wasn't high quality of the ship, but studies have shown that actually the metal that they used, the steel they used, was as good as you could get for the modern, you know, in that day and age. So it wasn't terrible. And then folks would ask about the crew, and then they found that, yeah, the crew wasn't really. And finally, the U.S. government did their own study and said it was an act of God that they hit that iceberg, right? And it was just bad luck. It was terrible, but it was bad luck on that day. But what's really interesting, right, where I'm getting at here, is that the strategy was, we are going to sell these high-end tickets. And when they did, they made a decision right before they left to remove some of the rescue boats from the top deck that were impeding or blocking the view of some of those first class passengers' views. So they had said, okay, well, we can still pass our security standard enough, right? If we take these off, if we take these lifeboats off, hundreds of lives would have been saved, right? Had they just kept them on board, but they were leaning in toward, how do we make the experience better for these high-end passengers, right? So we're all pulling these levers all the time, saying, what's more important, security or experience in this case, right? Which kind of ties to intuitiveness against those pillars. And that has to be tied to strategy. It just does. I mean, Spirit Airlines is a great example. I talk about this one a lot too. Spirit Airlines is really good, or I should say it's middle of the road, about getting you from point A to point B reasonably on time. They are middle of the pack if you look at the rankings. But the experience kind of stinks, right? I mean, if you want a bottle of water, you pay for it. If you want to get your boarding pass printed, you pay for it. There's a lot about the experience that's lacking. But Spirit Airlines says, we are going to be the ultra low cost provider in this space. Not even low cost, ultra low cost. That's their marketing pitch. They are telling you, you are going to pay the lowest cost for this. But, you know, as a result, we're going to get you to where you want to go, to your destination. But you might not have the best experience. And that's part of the trade-off. So, you know, is the quality of their experience the best? No, but that is intrinsically tied to what their corporate strategy is, which is, we're going to appeal to a broad market, but we're going to be that cost leader, right? And that by being a cost leader, we can also drive down our prices and appeal to that market, and they will know what they're getting with that offering. So I'm a big fan of knowing, you know, Michael Porter's classic strategy matrix of, what market are you going after and what's your advantage? Is it cost, or do you want to be differentiated? And just finding which of those four boxes, if you do that 2x2 matrix, who are you selling to, narrow or broad? What's my advantage? Differentiated or cost leader, and just saying, okay, this is the box we're going to live in. And Spirit Airlines has done a great job finding that box and living there and being comfortable in it. And we've had those conversations at Sugar CRM. I don't want to say too much about that, just given that, you know, private company and all, but you know, it's really important. It's really important to know who you are and that identity, that corporate identity, so that you can then go and make product decisions.
Mm-hmm. I love the Titanic analogy. So do you think if they were a little bit more focused on security, I guess, or quality, it might have been okay?
Yeah, the SaaS quality pillars sort of break down a little bit when you go outside of SaaS, but I think it's safety and security, you know, and then experience or intuitiveness probably are the ones that equate there. And they certainly could have done that, right? And now if they had done that, right, or let's say they just hadn't hit the iceberg, now what happens when they arrive, where were they going, New York? I don't even know. Yeah, they arrive, you know, in the U.S. and those passengers might, you know, complain a bit, right? And like, hey, this wasn't what we were promised. There was a lifeboat outside my window and I couldn't see anything. And maybe they don't take the next ride, right? So, you know, it's a tough decision. That's why I think in product management and in leadership in general, these decisions need to be made. And sometimes they are bets or they are gambles and there's risk involved.
I'd love to take this a little bit back to some more of your experience, especially for the listeners, because I know from my experience and certainly within the day job, I speak with so many different customers and prospects and former colleagues of mine. And it's a real challenge to get your team to operate in a way that kind of satisfies these different kind of pillars of product quality and to make sure that they're hitting the box. And I was wondering if you had any kind of examples on how you ensure quality, perhaps for your team. Like, are there any processes or rituals that you kind of go through with your team to make sure that they're thinking about this in the right way and that they're pulling the right levers?
Ooh, yeah, that's a great question. I'll try to give some tactical advice. Well, so I think one of the more important things that I've always advocated for, and I think it's sort of a polarizing topic, I'm not sure everyone agrees with me, is a lot of the time we look at maybe problems we're having or challenges we have, not just where I am today at Sugar CRM, this is probably other places that I've been, certainly one place in particular I won't name, but the answer to everything was, let's just go find more engineers. If we find more engineers, you know, and I know everyone's heard this before, but if we find more engineers, that'll, you know, the math on paper, right? This it'll work out. We'll be able to accomplish more. And I've always been an advocate that does not work, and that instead of spending the money on more engineers, you know, bring in less engineers, but higher quality engineers. I think quality people that take pride in their work and really, really care about their work are going to deliver high quality products. And I know that sounds like an obvious statement, but I do think it's the most important thing we can do as leaders is find people who just give a damn, sorry for the language, and, you know, are going to wake up at 2 a.m. and go, wait a minute, was that the right decision? Not every morning, right? We don't want them to be unhealthy, but just people who are thinking and about this stuff and, you know, at least for their work time, devoting their work, not just to getting stuff done or trying to finish the tickets that were assigned to them, but building the right things. And that to me is critical. And then to your point, Adam, like, how do you build it into your culture and your workforce and the way you operate? I had this interesting experience where I went to a brewery, seems to be a theme on this this episode. And I brought my family, and it was like a Sunday afternoon, and like football was on here in the States, and, you know, everyone was having a good time. And I looked across the brewery, and no lie, there's this big sign that's right above the garage door where the trucks go out, you know, where they probably ship the casks or the kegs of beer or whatever. And it says, if you're not proud of it, don't ship it. And it was a very simple sign, but it was large. It was kind of angled down, almost like it was staring at you if you were working there in the brewery itself. And I thought, That's such a genius way of making sure that people know what your mantra is, that it's quality all the time. So even in our language at Sugar CRM, I'm constantly talking about quality. I think one of the more important things we can do as product managers, we talked about the triangle before of more, faster, you know, less people, whatever it might be. I've pushed out plenty of releases because I just didn't think the quality was where it needed to be. Even though, you know, the pushback I would get is, but we said we'd have it out by this date. And I don't know who said it, so I'd love to attribute this to someone. I'm not going to do a good job, but someone once said, I saw this, you know, somewhere LinkedIn, no one remembers the date you published your product, right, or deployed your product. They remember the quality. They remember how they felt about it. That's the part that's going to stick. So if it's 1, 2, or 3 weeks sprint later, or even a couple sprints later that you have to release, and I've done that a few times now, and it's amazing to me the benefit you get from just waiting and not going so fast. And I know, again, the continuous discovery people will say, no, you got to push out the code and get customer feedback. But in a live environment where you've got a more mature product, I think it's much more important to put something out there that people are going to look at and go, oh yeah, that does the job for me. I get what they're doing here. Not this seems like it's lacking or could be a little bit more, or isn't that standard that I want it to be. And the last thing I'll say about culture, which I think is just critical, and hopefully everyone listening to this already has this in place. We had some of it, but we didn't have all of it at Sugar, is build in the measurements and metrics so that you can keep score of quality. And all six of those pillars that we talked about before, they can all be measured. I mean, our engineering team has the uptime stats, right? And they know how the system's performing for the most part. Intuitiveness, right? There's all sorts of apps out there. We use Pendo, which has been a great tool. It's probably one of my top five favorite products. it tells us how customers are using the product and if there's dips and where they're using the product. Security, obviously, you know, we use outside vendors to give us report cards basically on where we might need to do work there. And yeah, and I think all those things can be measured. And that way you'll always have your finger on the pulse of, are we delivering the quality that we need to deliver? So yeah, I think you know, those things together are probably what made the biggest difference for us.
Mm-hmm. I think you touched on a really good point around the people. Like, all the best product teams that I've been in, the people in the team like actually care about the work they're doing and the craft and the outcome they're trying to achieve. And it's absolute magic when you see that happening. And as especially within leadership roles, if you're able to kind of create and foster that environment. And I think hiring the right people 100%, and you know, the old mantra, like hire slow and fire fast, or hire fast and fire fast if you need to get people in quickly if you're in a startup. And then measuring success, like people being accountable to it. And I think for me, like by far the best teams that I've been in, especially when I was back working in IC work, is around the team defining what success looks like, the team defining how they're going to get there, what their quality looks like, because then they're so accountable to it as a group. And just like you were saying, like, it's, if you notice, I don't know, someone's slacking off on the team, you can hit them up, because as a group, you created those goals together and the leadership team created that environment where you're just passionate about the work you're doing. So I think that's super important. And another piece is that I heard on, I think it was yesterday, I was listening to one of Lenny's podcasts and I talked about Ramp. So Ramp have just gone through this like incredible growth. And one of the key things they talk about was about how you compensate higher performers. And his view is a little bit controversial, and not to go off on too much of a rabbit hole here, but rather than his, I can't remember the name of it, but his name, I'll drop it in the comments. But his view as a product leader at Ramp was that you should really be compensating the highest performers and focusing on smaller quality teams, because the smaller the team, the higher quality the individual, the larger the quality product that they'll create, which is
interesting.
Yeah, bit of a unique kind of way to look at it as well. If you kind of look at the rest of the industry, we're really focusing on benchmarking and making sure people are in the same bands, whereas he had quite a different take on it. So I think we could probably do a whole podcast on salary bands and what that means for quality outcomes. One of the things I'd love to wrap up with are just like, what are some of those key resources you would recommend listeners to kind of go back to, and what are some of those questions that you should really be reminding yourself and the team when you think about shipping quality products? So you mentioned Iron Triangle, the Strategy Matrix by Michael Porter. I'll make sure to drop down these. Are there any other kind of key resources or questions that you think would be helpful for listeners to read up on and kind of think about as they embark on this journey?
Yeah. I'll throw out a shameless plug here. So I wrote a book called The Quality Lever. You probably heard me use the term lever a few times. It captures some of what we talked about today and goes more in depth and has case studies from my career, but more importantly, you know, spans all sorts of different examples between Apple and Major League Baseball. And that was supposed to be a blog article. And the more I wrote about it, I thought, oh gosh, it branches out to strategy and culture and influence and decisions and product strategy. And I thought maybe this could become a book. So it's full color. There's a lot of art in it too. It's a quick read. I hope people could find that to be really helpful. Anything by Michael Porter, his classic, you know, books on strategy would be great. And I think you do a great job, Adam, with the Product Makers community on Slack, and love to chat with people there. You can also find me on LinkedIn if you have any questions or want to reach out. John Zilch, probably search for me. Not a lot of us with that name. And would love to chat or hear anyone else's take on this.
Awesome, Joe. Thank you very much. And I guess one final question for you as well. Is there anything our listeners can do to help you out, John, in your journey, in your crafting of different resources and books?
Another shameless plug, I guess. I do have a couple YouTube channels. One is called My Favorite Product, where I just interview product managers about their favorite products. So it is fun and supposed to be really informal and casual, but at the same time, you do get a look into how products product managers think, and that always I always learn just from doing the interviews, a couple things about how people look into products and deal with product management. So we'd love to have you on if anyone's listening and wants to be part of that. And what else? Yeah, I mean, as I've written the book, I sent it out to some folks for feedback, and they said, oh, you forgot about these 10 examples of like where people were, you know, prioritizing dates or scope over quality. And like, or my example at this company was like this. And they write me these long passages about like their experiences, which makes me feel so good because I realize that it's relatable and that people have their own stories. So I just love to hear it. And it helps me also kind of frame my thinking around it. So again, through LinkedIn or my email, johnzilch@gmail.com. Yeah, I'd love to hear your story and learn from it.
Yeah, I love the YouTube idea. Is it One Night in Product? But K-N-I? No?
No, that's Jason Knight.
Oh, sorry. That's the one. It looks like you were on there.
Yes, I was on there. Yeah. I love that one too, though. I will recommend that one. Jason's great. It's just on YouTube right now. It's called My Favorite Product. I can send a link to you.
Cool. Yeah. I look forward to checking it out and also getting a chance to go on it. All right, John, yes. We covered a lot of ground. Thank you very much. We talked about all the different nuances of product quality. It was awesome to hear your view on it as well from a SaaS B2B and also a remote perspective as well. That was really cool. I hope listeners were able to get some good insight in terms of the environment that you create, how to approach it, what they can do differently. So we'd love to hear success story folks or challenges that you have and how you're approaching it. So with that, thank you very much, John. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thanks, Adam. Enjoyed it.